everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. Yeah. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the critically acclaimed network. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic, and everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. For the purposes of this particular podcast, you may call me Rockmeister McCool. Every spelling is correct.
And here's how this works. You email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. And you can ask us about anything. You can talk about something we discuss in our podcasts, ask us questions about film history or how things work in the industry or what our favorite food additives are. I don't know, whatever you want, really. And we answer as many letters as we can every single week. We missed last week. Sorry about that. We're going to try to play a bit of catch up right now. And we're just going to dive right in. Whitney.
Yes.
Tell us about our first email.
Our first email comes from Adrian. Hello, Adrian.
Hi.
It says, hey, Mr. Bibbs and Mr. McCool, greetings from Toulouse, France.
Ooh, fancy.
Bonjour. This is my first time writing. I'm going to say I'm going to keep it short, but I feel like there are some things you didn't mention about the movie Sylvia Scarlett. Oh. Since I'm a huge Katharine Hepburn fan, I need to add a few things.
Real fast, just for people who might not catch up, our most recent episode of the Streaming Club, a show where we have a Patreon poll every week and you decide what older movie we're going to watch out of various streaming services. We talked about the early Katharine Hepburn film Sylvia Scarlett, co-starring Cary Grant. And it's a film that deals with a lot of issues of gender identity in a way that might have been ahead of its time. They might not have had the terminology or the dialogue necessary to explore it the way we would now. And it led to an interesting conversation. And we basically begged our listeners who had seen the film to give us their perspective because we're sure that there are things that we missed or that there are different angles on the film. Yeah. So we'd love to. I'm looking forward to this email.
Yeah. Adrian says, the most important thing is how the movie parallels Katharine Hepburn's life in some ways. You talked about her character clearly being gender fluid, just that we didn't know what to call it back in 1935. The same could be said for Katharine Hepburn. We all know about her wearing pants and breaking codes at the time, but more than that, when she was a child, she used to dress as a boy and wanted everybody to call her Jimmy. This isn't some weird rumor, by the way. She even says it in her autobiography, which is very fun read, but I digress. Also, George Cukor, being an openly gay man, as openly gay as the studio system would allow at the time anyway, directing the picture, and Hepburn herself, who also allegedly equally enjoyed the company of both women and men, according to some of her closest friends, but as for many things at the time, we will never know the truth. Anyway, with those two voices working together with that subject, the queer undertones of some of the characters is definitely not accidental.
Oh, sure.
I feel like you didn't mention those two points unless I dozed off for a bit. So I thought you would like this. Thank you for the podcast and keeping me entertained during my daily walks and for the movie recommendations like The Watermelon Woman. Oh, well, you're quite welcome. Cheryl Dunier is wonderful.
Absolutely.
Best regards, Adrian. P.S. You should also read about Kate's mother, who is even more interesting than her daughter, and that is saying something and shows why Kate has never been afraid to be daring during her long career.
That's exciting. Yeah. And that's a kind of a meta level narrative where the audience isn't necessarily going to always know the backstory of the people making the movie. Yeah. And sometimes we know more than others when we discuss these films. I knew a bit about Katharine Hepburn's life, but not enough that I could speak with it with a lot of confidence. So we just sort of alluded to it and moved on. And same thing with George Cukor. We did mention that he was gay and it was an open secret, as they would say, where it's not so much public knowledge, but everyone around knew. Mm. And yeah, I you're watching Sylvia Scarlett. Yeah, this isn't an accident that they're talking about queer issues. But there's also a lot that they're not allowed to talk about, even if they knew the right way to talk about it. So it's this very weird, fascinating movie. Please listen to the episode we did about it. I think it's an interesting film and deserves to be seen. But yeah, it's kind of complex and you kind of have to like decipher it a little bit because of all like the hoops they had to jump through with the production code and social mores and a lot of coding involved.
Mores,
sorry.
That's fine.
I was going to go with some sort of an eel joke, but I decided not to. Also, I couldn't do it.
There's a Far Side strip that it's a bunch of eels at a party drinking and talking, and the caption is just social mores.
Oh.
Yeah, it's really cute.
Yeah.
I actually did know about Katharine Hepburn's sexuality, and I don't think I brought it up. We did bring up George Cukor's sexuality, though. Yes, and yeah, they would be dealing with queerness, but I would like if anybody knows about sort of queer terminology, especially trans terminology in the 1930s, I'd love to hear a little bit of that as well, because, like you said, this feels like a film that didn't know the vocabulary of how to deal with gender identity issues yet.
And even if it had vocabulary at the time, it probably wasn't allowed to say it outright.
Yeah. So it feels like they weren't coding something that they knew how to say. It feels like they're trying to figure out a way to say that. And I like it for it. It's a little bit sloppy in that regard. But thank you for bringing that up about Katharine Hepburn and her life and her sexuality and gender identity. Because that does really color it. And she probably brought a lot of that to it.
Oh, I can only imagine. Mm. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for that letter. That was awesome.
Here is a letter from Laurie F. Hello, Laurie F.
Hi.
Hi, Bibbs and Whitney. I thought I'd take some time tonight and send emails to my favorite podcast.
And us. That was plenty.
Okay. And I'm glad you included us as well.
Seriously, thank you. That means a lot to us.
Yeah. I'm not sure exactly how I came to find Critically Acclaimed. It might have been suggested after I started listening to Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers that was suggested by Cabot Cove Confidential, a Murder, She Wrote podcast.
Awesome podcast. I haven't listened to that. That sounds like an amazing podcast.
I started listening to you guys in late 2020. What got me hooked was your discussion of the latest edition of Little Women. The way you talked about it shouldn't have shocked me, but it did. You didn't treat it like a chick flick, but rather you had so much reverence for it that I immediately watched it. It's a C+ for me. Also, speaking of your rating system, at first I thought you meant C+, SEE+, SEE-, as in you should or should not see it. It works either way, and I chuckle at myself.
Yeah, it kind of does. I literally never thought of that before.
No, me neither. I've only ever thought of the letter grade.
That's really funny.
Anyway, I've come to appreciate your intellectual and worldly approach to discussion of film. I'm from Alberta, which is the Texas of Canada. And a genuine intellectual sensitivity is a rare commodity up here. I'm a $1 Patreon, and I'm loving Holy Batman, and I'm a lifelong fan of The Batman. I teach pottery classes, and I've switched to teaching over Zoom through the pandemic. I've gained some insight into the talking into the ether aspect of what you do, so I thought I'd talk back. Oh, well, thank you. This is actually the reason we like to have these letter shows. We want to put your voices. It's my voice, but put your voices out there. The films you recommended to me that have hit hard for me in no particular order: Blowout, The Conversation, and Starstruck, the Australian musical. And number one, Dr. X. Holy shit, I love this movie. From your discussion of Code Era films, I have extra bits to throw at my trivia team. This week, Whitney mentioned The Critic, and I had forgotten about that. I'm rewatching it as I type. There's an entire episode where Phil Hartman voices many characters. He died way too young and tragically. What are your top picks for Died Too Young? And you would have loved to see more from them. The Critic is so funny and so smart and so tragic that there's... it's so tragic that there's so much fat shaming in it. Not cool in the 90s. That's a big running gag, is that Jay Sherman's a heavy guy.
They were kind of following the lead of The Simpsons on that. A lot of the Homer Simpson jokes.
I don't like that fat shaming was such a common theme, and I'm embarrassed at how much I laugh at it. Because I was laughing at myself. I was never svelte, and I've been working out, but I still see myself as a fat guy. And so, I was kind of laughing at myself with a lot of those fat jokes from a lot of the shows I saw in the 90s.
Listen, it's possible to tell a good joke. It's possible, anyway, to tell a good joke about almost anything. And sometimes there's just a good joke about what it's like to be fat.
Yeah.
There are things that you deal with when you're fat that you don't necessarily deal with when you're skinny. There have been times in my life when I have lost a lot of weight. And there are things, just people treated me differently, or there are issues that didn't arise or did arise, and sometimes there's a good joke to be had there. The whole he's fat, ha 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 ha, look at how fat he is. Fatty fat fat fat. It's a low blow.
It's a low
punching
blow.
It's shitty.
It's an easy joke, but when Rush Limbaugh crashes in from the floor above and he crashes through the floor himself, and then you hear them through the hole saying, "Hey, I'll race you to the lobby," that makes me giggle.
That's at least absurdist. And that's, again, it's possible to tell a funny joke. And, of course, it's all a matter of taste. But, there's some low blow shots in there. It sucks.
Laurie continues. Episode 0 is a genius project. Oh, well, thank you.
Thank you.
It's actually William's idea.
I'm going to give
you credit for that.
Yeah.
I've listened to the entire Rocky Horror series and haven't yet gone back to catch on Star Wars. Now that I've said all of that, I'll summarize and say that the pandemic has been hard, and passing the time watching movies and listening to your shows has made it more bearable.
Thank you.
Keep that sweet content rolling, Laurie F. Well, thank you very much for the letter. And as for actors who died too soon, like in the height of their career, and you wanted to see more of them.
I mean, everyone, really. I mean, like, just as a blanket statement, I wish no one died ever. That'd be great for me. But
Richard Donner just passed away. He was 91, and he was preparing Lethal Weapon 5.
Yeah.
Did I want to see Lethal Weapon 5? Not necessarily, but, you know, he wanted to keep working, and that's important.
Jesus, I'm just trying to remember. I think of all the young actors who were taken from us often through to things like drug use or something like that. People like River Phoenix, who was enormously talented.
Yeah, or Heath Ledger, for that matter.
Oh my God, that poor guy. Yeah. Philip Seymour Hoffman wasn't particularly young, but he still had a long career ahead of him. And he was one of the greatest actors that we had at the time. And Robin Williams, also not young, but God, I miss him so much.
Aww.
He was such a reassuring presence. Even his bad movies, he was still so sweet and funny in them. Jesus, I'm trying to think now because,
plenty of comedians. One that, it didn't hit me hard, but it hurts whenever I think about it is Mitch Hedberg.
Yeah. I was just thinking about Mitch Hedberg.
Mitch Hedberg was a stand-up comedian that, who died of a drug overdose. And, he did something that not a lot of comedians do. He just sort of, he didn't really tell jokes, but he had like one-liners.
Yeah.
His entire act was made up of just little one-liners. He didn't have a long, elaborate bits or observational humor.
If a Mitch Hedberg joke lasted more than three sentences, it was weird.
Yeah. It's like, Kit Kats have Kit Kat printed in the chocolate. That robs you of chocolate. That's the whole bit. Yeah. This shirt is dry clean only. This shirt is dry clean only, which means it's dirty.
One of my favorite jokes. Because we all know that's basically true. Yes.
Yeah.
We're not always on top of that shit now, are we?
If you want to talk to me after the show, I'll be surprised. That's Mitch Hedberg for you. And,
brilliant comedian.
He actually made a movie. He wrote a movie that somebody else. Yeah. It was called Los Enchiladas, but it was never released. I got to see it at this sort of private event.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to see it, and that's me bragging a little bit. He had great work in him. Mm-hmm. He could have kept on going and like was not slipping at all. He was really on his game, and drugs just sort of took him too early.
Another one that I think is pretty well known, although I hear him talked about less and less, so I want to make sure people remember how great Andy Kaufman was.
Mm.
Andy Kaufman was such a high concept comedian that he went past high concept and into how the fuck did you come up with that? Like his many of his routines are just so mind bogglingly conceived. And he seemed to make him effortless. He was absolutely a genius. But I'll tell you someone who is a person whose career I didn't know about until we did Cancel Too Soon. And then we saw Cancel Too Soon is a show where we review TV shows that lasted one season or less. And we did a series just really randomly. I happened to pick up a DVD in like a used bin of the complete series of Voyagers.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
Voyagers was this wonderful, like, American version of Doctor Who, basically, about this time-traveling adventurer who was kind of like the hunky jock older brother of a little kid who gets dragged along on the adventures, and the little kid knows all about history, and the time-traveling adventurer actually doesn't, and it was a really good dynamic, and they formed this really great younger, older brother kind of bond. And the guy who played the adventurer, Phineas Bogg,
John Eric Hexum
was
great.
Eric Hexum. And John Eric Hexum, oh my God, was he charming. Just an absolutely wonderful, almost effortless screen presence that just he was clearly destined for big things. He was going to be in movies. He would have played superheroes. Yeah. He would have been a major star. Voyagers did okay, but they didn't get picked up. He was doing another show, and there was a tragic onset accident, and he died.
Mm.
And he was unbelievably talented. I'm such a huge fan.
Unbelievably talented and, like, Bop Magazine ready.
Oh, he was just an
unbelievably attractive man.
Hunky. He was like Chris Hemsworth before we had Chris Hemsworth.
Yeah. Look, you look up John Eric Hexum, and, like, the first thing you're going to find is, like a shirtless poster of him. Like, just sort of posing, all greased up. He was like a teen idol waiting to happen.
Yeah, he was gonna be like at least, I don't know, I'm trying to think. It's at least Dennis Quaid. You know, at least that kind of like just handsome, charismatic guy who's gonna have at least a couple of great decades in him. And that's one where I didn't know about him. He died when I was like, what, maybe like 2 years old or something. And only in retrospect doing the research do I find out like just how amazing this guy was and how sad it was that he died so young. Yeah, that one really hurt me a lot. And in 30 years later, 30 years later, that hurt me, you know, like that sucks. I want to thank you though for the email, and I'm glad that we were able to excite you about seeing Little Women, and I hopefully it really pisses me off when people think about like art as so specifically gendered. Like there are movies for chicks, and there are movies for bros, and I mean there are definitely movies that have an audience in mind, but you can totally appreciate anything.
When I don't use the term chick flick anymore, it's too reductive,
it's arguably insulting, and
I still use phrases like dad film, and I think when I use phrases like that, it's meant to denote certain descriptors, not to say that only dads will enjoy that.
They're typically movies that are about dads or older men,
Or about they cover a specific set of topics that. People of a certain experience know that their dad is into
World War II
movies, car movies. Those are the kinds of films I describe as dad movies. Are all dads into that stuff? No, definitely not.
It's a cliche, but
it's just a cliche, and I think it's shorthand. That's the word I was looking for. It's shorthand.
Yeah.
I try to steer myself. This is a sort of a separate topic, but I've been trying to steer myself away from this notion that films should be viewed as being for a certain audience.
Yeah.
I think films, and I've been saying this for years, films are for whoever can buy a ticket to them.
Yeah.
Really super violent films aren't for kids because kids can't buy a ticket to that.
Mm-hmm. And there are definitely films that are about like ideas that are so complicated that maybe younger people haven't experienced them yet. And maybe those movies aren't necessarily going to hit as hard, but I watched a lot of those movies or read a lot of books that were about more mature concerns that I'm still figuring out now.
Yeah.
I still appreciated them. I just didn't get them on the, it wasn't on the wavelength necessarily.
But I would like to think that audiences are going to be open-minded enough to accept whatever perspective the film is giving them.
Yeah.
And if this is a movie about women and women's interests and you're not a woman, you would at least, I would hope, understand that you're getting, you're opening yourself up to that perspective.
Yeah.
So this is a movie for women. Women can understand this, and a man seeing this movie should be able to understand that.
Yeah, I've never understood this whole thing where like, someone was online and they were talking about how like Julia Roberts has only made a couple of good movies, and I'm like, first off, fuck you.
She's made a couple like 30?
If we're setting the baseline at good, at least like 36.
Yeah.
All right. If we're going, setting the bar at great, I'd say at least 15. Like she's made some amazing motion pictures.
She's a hugely long career. She's very prolific.
And I was thinking about like, you know, how like I was looking at people being derogatory about stuff like Steel Magnolias. And I'm like, Steel Magnolias is fucking awesome. Mm. I was watching Steel Magnolias. I saw it when it came out. We saw it in theaters. Mm. I was a little kid. It's about adult issues and motherhood and dying of diabetes and marital relationships. And I'm thinking about how that movie is so smartly written and the characters are so richly drawn that as a little kid, I got it. I mean, I didn't appreciate all the depth necessarily, but I was able to follow along. I cried at all the moments that are supposed to make you cry. You don't have to disregard something just because there's this weird societal expectation that you're not supposed to be interested in it. And I think that once we start putting that aside and just try to experience everything on its own terms and have taste, that we're all allowed to have taste. We're all allowed to like say like, oh, this genre doesn't generally do it for me, but you should be open to it all. And that's the thing that excites me the most. And I think once you, some people ask me, like, what's your, like, favorite, like, genre, or what's a genre you don't like? And I'm like, as a film critic, I don't really get to do that. There's stuff I gravitate towards generally, but, like, I'll watch a horror movie perhaps more readily than anything else if I have free time. But I have to find something to like in all of them, don't I? I have to understand what makes all these different genres work. I have to understand what makes all these different types of movies work.
Yeah.
You have to open yourself up to that possibility. And I really want to encourage everyone else to do that, because if you're not open to the idea that a movie that's in a genre you were sort of told wasn't for you, or was for a different group of people, and you're not supposed to be watching that, which I know too many people get that general sense, you're missing out. That's it. You're just missing out on amazing art. That sucks. Like, I want you to have that art.
If toxic masculinity is scaring you off of Little Women, you're lost. Little Women is great.
Little Women is a wonderful motion picture. All of them.
Yeah.
And, they're all good. They're all good. I never saw, like, the Leah Thompson modern day one. So it's like, I think Netflix did it. I didn't hear good things, but I'm talking about the major releases of Little Women. They're all good. They're all good films.
So, and I'm embarrassed. Someday I'll read it. I haven't read Little Women.
I think you'll like it. It's a good read.
It's just one that has escaped me. I haven't been avoiding it. But
it's fun. There's a lot of books out there. I get it. It's not like you've been avoiding literature about women or anything like that. We haven't gotten around to that. We're all catching up, aren't we?
Yeah.
All right, let's move on.
Next letter comes from Cecil.
Hello, hi, Cecil.
Hi, Bibbs and Rockmeister. You are wrong.
Oh, okay. Well, fair enough. Goodbye, everybody. We're canceling all the podcasts.
We're wrong.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I found an error on the internet. Hi, Biz and Rockmeister. You are wrong about the plot holes in The Lord of the Rings.
Ah.
Specifically, the Eagles and Tom Bombadil.
Okay. So real fast, we were talking about Lord of the Rings, and we were talking about how there's...
Rather idly about Lord of the Rings.
I can't remember exactly what podcast we were talking about, but basically we're talking about how, if you really look at it, there's a few inconsistencies, and, like, theoretically, the Eagles could have just dropped the ring.
Fly the ring and dive into the volcano.
Theoretically, that's a joke that's been told over and over again, but technically, theoretically, it happened. And then Tom Bombadil apparently was cut from the Lord of the Rings movies because he was so resistant to the ring that it kind of, like, undercut its power. But maybe we're wrong about all of that. That's what we said before, anyway. Let's hear what Cecil has to say.
The Eagles couldn't carry the ring because there is a giant evil eye that would see them and instantly kill them, on top of being too proud to work for the hobbits. I don't know, the Eagles, like, have character, like, they're proud.
No, they're,
like,
but
are they intelligent?
Yeah, they are, actually. Oh, okay. And they got their own thing, and that they're actually one of the armies that is in the Battle of the Five Armies. They have their own agency and everything, and they've got their own lives and whatever. And I would say, does he go on about the Eagles? Or did you move on to the next
one? There's a little bit more here. But
I'll wait till we talk about the Eagles to present my counterpoint. But
also, Tom Bombadil couldn't do it because he is nature, and is above all of this petty ring crap that he would forget about it. Tom Bombadil wasn't in the movie, but the eye would still have seen the Eagles flying. That's why, and the fact that the Eagles keep getting brought up by half-assed, smart-ass people who think CinemaSins is actual criticism, I mean that when you do it, you can't sink to that level. Never go full CinemaSins.
Okay, I didn't mean to go CinemaSins, but is there more to learn?
That's the end. Yeah.
All right, I didn't mean to go CinemaSins. If you're not familiar with CinemaSins, they're a podcast or a YouTube series where they go through every single nitpicky flaw in a movie, and every once in a while there'll be a legit critique or gripe or anachronism or something, but oftentimes what we're really doing is just nitpicking something to death, and there's an inherent smugness to it that's really off-putting.
Nitpicking, it from my perspective, used to be like just sort of a fun thing to do with things you've seen a lot. You know, films weren't meant to be viewed 100 times on home video, at least not when home video was new.
Yeah. Look at all, like, the little gags we have about Star Wars, where if we'd only seen Star Wars once, we could never do a joke. Like, all, like, the Robot Chicken Star Wars episodes that they did, 90% of those would fall flat because none of us remember those stupid details from a movie, but we all know the little details, and we think that we're overthinking it.
Yeah, we've watched the movie a lot. And you had an excellent point once where the conversation in the movie Clerks about how... they're thinking about, like, the private contractors they would have to hire to build the Death Star.
Yeah.
That's a comedy scene, because they're overthinking that scene. And you pointed out, that's a career now.
Yeah.
Writing these long articles about these tiny little plot details that are actually really meaningless to the experience of watching the movie are now kind of paramount importance. And I always felt, when I haven't seen a lot of CinemaSins, but I've seen some.
Yeah.
And I thought they were just sort of goofing.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was meant to stand in for real criticism, or that they were even pointing out things that were really important about the plot. They were sort of like funning on the practice of overthinking
stuff. The problem with CinemaSins, and we've talked about it a long time ago, but mm-hmm. like the problem with CinemaSins, I don't think is so much exactly what they're doing. The problem is that their runaway popularity has changed the conversation so that they now have an outsized influence based on the ultimately very silly thing that they do. And I think it's a little irresponsible to keep doing it the same way when ultimately what they're doing is suggesting in the conversation with a very deadpan straight face that these are actual problems.
Bring down the quality of the movie.
The gag is that treating these like actual problems is ridiculous. But you're still doing that gag, and people, and you're not, I don't think they're always winking enough. People understand that it's satire, if indeed it is. I don't know them well enough to make that distinction. I know they've claimed it is, but I've also known that some people don't take it that way. And if your people are taking the wrong thing from your message and you're not correcting them, that's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
So unfortunately, there's a lot of people who look at the CinemaSins way of doing things and they think that's film criticism. And
it's a bit. It's not criticism. Yeah, it's comedy.
Sometimes criticism, we talk about these things. My philosophy often is, especially if you're watching it for the first time, if you're distracted by that kind of a thing, the thing itself may be a little problem, but it's indicative of a bigger problem, which is that I'm not immersed enough to overlook it.
Yeah.
Like that's the real issue here.
Yeah. If the film is grabbing you in some sort of way, it could have all kinds of problems that you're totally willing to overlook. Yeah.
Which is why when there are films that do grab us, but we watch them over and over and over again, and after a while those details come out anyway, even though we still have a lot of affection for it, which is why we can goof on Star Wars and still like Star Wars. We can goof on Lord of the Rings and still like Lord of the Rings. To your points about Lord of the Rings, Tom Bombadil, yeah, fair enough. Regardless, you leave him out of the movie because you don't want to have that conversation and it's distracting and you just want to keep the propulsion going. As for the Eagles, I don't know if the movie, I mean, again, I'm looking at the movie rules and the way they have the Eye of Sauron at that big tower. I don't know if it has like a laser on that. I think it's just a spotlight.
it would see the Eagles coming, but they're flying over, you know, these, they don't have missiles yet in this universe.
I mean, I guess they could have catapults and shit. It might be dangerous for the Eagles, but theoretically,
just fly higher.
Exactly. Theoretically, this could easily be done with a moderate amount of risk, but it could be done. And one could look at it less as, we're doing it for the hobbits, then we're doing it for the Eagles. Because the Eagles aren't going to necessarily, like, it's not going to be like Sauron's going to be like, well, I've conquered the whole world, subjugated all under my control. Not going to bother the Eagles, of course. Those guys are cool. Right on, Eagles. Eagles are like, yeah, wing bump.
Wing bump.
Yeah. No, the Eagles are going to get shit too. So, listen, there's... When you come up with like a minor issue like this in a movie, if you can come up with in your head a little headcanon to explain it, then we're fine. You know, it's like, oh, why wouldn't the Eagles do that? Ah, they're too proud. Fine.
Yeah.
Whatever. Who cares? Like, it doesn't really matter. As long as there's an okay explanation for it and you can write it off. And then it stops being distracting and then who cares?
Yeah.
But ultimately, still who cares? I love the Lord of the Rings movies. The original trilogy in particular. They're really, really good. And just every once in a while, you start thinking about it. It's like, you know, the Eagles aren't really pulling their fucking weight, are they? The Gandalf, you know, from a tower, but, you know, like, won't actually, like, save the world. Like, get on your shit, Eagles.
And I'm not a fan of those movies, but it's not because of, like, plot points like that. It's, you know, bigger problems about sort of the project in general. It's, you know, kind of an ambitious thing more than like a moving or exciting thing. And then they get like really preoccupied with war and stuff. And there's too much of it.
It's too much war in general. Moving on.
Here's a letter from Max. Hi, Max.
Hi, Max.
Hello, Bibbs and Whitney. I am here to talk about a phrase you have already talked about quite often, but some Twitter happenings this past weekend have me thinking about it more. The phrase is, let people enjoy things.
Oh, yeah.
I agree with this phrase is used in all the wrong ways, to deflect any negative reviews, and the big franchise movie is not the little guy in this scenario. For example, I really did love Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker, despite many critics and fans not caring for it. But every negative review or comment was interesting to me, and I was not going to take offense to them.
Okay.
That being said, I've noticed something in the early reaction to F9, outwardly mocking of the fans of the film in a way I haven't seen before. I enjoy the Fast and Furious movies a lot. They are the movies my dad and I have always had the tradition of seeing on opening night, and we watch them together whenever we have a lazy movie day.
Sounds fun.
I have no delusions about what they are as films. And they are consistently fun, and I enjoy the characters, and I have and they have one of the most diverse core casts in American film.
Yeah.
I didn't love F9, but it got a casual passing grade for me as a fan, and I expected negative reviews. I didn't expect one critic on Twitter with a prominent following to repost many positive reviews of the movie with laughing emojis, making fun of people for giving it a positive score. I saw another prominent movie pundit say that the box office success of Fast and Furious is a sign that movie theaters are saved and movies are dead. And
be able to hear my eyes rolling right now.
We're critics. Those muscles are very strong. And another who said that you couldn't be a true movie critic if you liked F9.
Oh, that's not cool. Come on. That's some geeky bullshit. I don't know who said
that. Saw fans of the movies taking a lot of hits instead of the movie itself. Yes, Fast and Furious likely has some toxic fans, but it's nothing compared to Star Wars or DC or Marvel movies from what I have seen. So Florence, I am saying to these people, let people enjoy things. Sorry for such a long letter and a rant. This is a little more of a... To end this on a positive note, do either of you have movies you love because of any correlation with family members?
Oh.
Thanks for all the amazing art you two provide, Max.
A couple of things. So there's two distinct questions there, and we'll get to the family members in one second. Regarding let people enjoy things, they came from a comic strip, and it was someone sitting on a couch with somebody who was trying to enjoy something, and someone was actively mocking their enjoyment.
It was a sporting event.
It was a sporting event. Yeah. They were making fun of sports, and someone said, hey, let people enjoy things. Stop being a dick.
Yeah, well,
and that,
it was that they leaned over, and they like pinched their lips shut. Yeah. And they said, shh, because I think that the shh is the important part of that.
Yeah, it's basically,
let people enjoy things.
Because that's one where someone is actively attempting to enjoy something in the moment, and you're just trying to suck the joy out of the room. The problem is that panel, the pinching and the people enjoy things without context, became used to shut down opposition to popular things.
Yeah.
And what it basically came down to is you couldn't punch upwards.
Yeah.
Punching downwards is usually and almost always, pretty much always shitty. Punching upwards at maybe the most popular thing and just saying, hey, you know, there's some problems with that. And that panel became used to silence people from basically contributing to the conversation if they don't like the thing.
Yeah.
That's not to say people can't be dicks about it. Sometimes people are dicks about everything. But that was the real problem with that comic.
To give credit where credit's due, the artist is named Adam Ellis.
Yes.
And the strip comes from Books of Adam.
Yeah. And he actually ends up doing another comic strip to just sort of...
Where he addressed that. Yeah.
How
it was being misused a lot in a lot of ways.
And, yeah, and to their credit. And ultimately, it also...
In fact, there was a really kind of dark strip where another character was talking to the strip. And, like, the strip was, like, an anthropomorphized. It had, like, little arms and legs. And they're, like, out in the snow. And he's got, like, a tear in his eyes and a shotgun. It's like, it's time to take you out. I'm so... It's like, no, man. Like, this isn't what it meant. No, it's time. It's like...
The other thing that presupposes, which kind of pisses me off, is the idea that you can't enjoy criticism.
Mm.
It's never, let people enjoy criticism. Let people enjoy speaking critically about something and discussing the pros and cons of something and having a forum in which they can actually articulate what something that, even if they like it, something that it doesn't do right.
Mm.
People basically want to shout down dissent.
Mm.
And that sucks. That really sucks. However, that works both ways, and you can totally be this weird kind of, like, I don't like something, ergo, people who like it are idiots or wrong, and I'm sure I've probably said some hyperbolic bullshit along those lines. And,
oh, definitely.
And especially when I was younger, and you know what, I'm embarrassed about that, and that wasn't helping anything. I was just young and not really thinking about, like, what kind of environment that creates for discourse. That's not fun, and that doesn't help anybody. To say that, like, if you like this, you're not a true fan, or if you don't like this, you're not a true fan. That's some bullshit right there.
The farthest I'll go is, like, there are many movies I hate.
Mm-hmm.
Some I hate with a fiery passion.
Sure.
That a lot of people like. I hate Space Jam.
Yeah.
I think Space Jam is one of the worst things.
I don't disagree with you.
And a lot of people really, really like it. And I don't disparage them for liking it.
No.
But I'm not going to say it's good because they like it.
No, you don't have to change your opinion. Exactly my point.
Yeah.
You should be able to speak critically about something everyone else enjoys.
Hmm.
And you should never, and honestly, no one should be a dick about it. If you're friends and you can like speak jestingly with somebody directly and that environment is very secure and you know it, maybe then. But in a public forum like Twitter, if you, even if you are trying to be funny, it usually just comes across like being a dick. And it makes people feel bad about liking things. Some people are confident enough in their opinions that it doesn't affect them. But not everyone's like that. Especially when you're younger and just getting into the film industry. And maybe there are people, critics, who you like or think are respectable. And when they speak like that, all of a sudden you think to yourself, well, shit, I liked this. I guess I'd better stop. Who the fuck does that help? It's bullshit. So don't do that. It's not helpful. And it's not helping anybody. You can be critical, but don't try to paint everybody with this weird essentialist brush where, like, if they like something, they're bad or inferior. That's bullshit.
Well, I mean, it all stems from a bigger problem. It's not necessarily a problem of certain critics trying to bully, disparage, or make people feel bad about the things they like. I think that's actually not as widespread a phenomenon as necessarily actually happens in the real world. But
I've seen it done in person, and I've definitely seen a few people with influence be articulate in that way, usually jestingly, but it's still a shitty thing to say.
I think it bears repeating that Twitter is not the real world.
Yeah.
And when you are on Twitter a lot and you are searching hashtags a lot, you get to see concentrated opinions. You get to see a concentrated small group of people in a really powerful dose.
Yeah.
And that is not necessarily emblematic of a wider fandom at large. It's just the people who are loudest. So getting a general consensus on something is pretty difficult these days. And you can say, well, you know, consensus opinion seems to be blank from my experience on social media. But remember, your social media is being altered because of AI.
Well, because of you.
What you're following. And outrage is a good way to keep that AI going. So if you're really outraged about something, you're going to encounter it more.
It's just like you have a group of friends, you're all interested in the same stuff. There's a decent chance your opinions about art will coalesce on some level.
Yeah.
It'll be kind of similar, and you'll think that everyone you know likes blank, and then something will happen. You go off to college, you go travel somewhere, or you'll start dating, and you run into a new circle of friends or something, and all of a sudden, you find out that not everyone shares that opinion.
Yeah.
That's just, you got kind of caught in a microcosm, and Twitter is a large microcosm. But it's still a microcosm.
It's still a microcosm.
Yeah, it's larger than maybe the number of people I would have lunch with. But I think it's still a small number of people, all things considered.
Yeah, there's a billion people on Twitter, but I think what you see is going to be a microscopic sampling of what's actually of the people who are using the platform. As for critics who say really brazen things like, you can't like this film and be a fan of cinema, well, I'd like to read the whole review. Clearly they didn't like it, and that's a very brazen thing to say. It's an eye-catching thing to say, and some critics like to play fast and loose with those kinds of phrases. I like to think that maybe it was being wielded a little bit more tactfully than just that quote taken out of context would be.
Mm-hmm.
That particular one seems pretty brazen and kind of confrontational.
Again, I don't know who said that. I don't know if that's paraphrased or whatever, but if that's exactly as described, that's shitty. And it's another reason why Twitter is difficult, because it's hard to have nuance on Twitter.
Yeah.
So you can have like a long, complicated thing where you can say to yourself, I actually think this is a really negative thing, and its popularity has a ripple effect, which is problematic for the industry at large or for the way stories are told. And we can have that conversation. Mm. But to simply say something that brazen in a very short tweet, it becomes like an ultimatum.
Yeah.
And so it's dangerous to wield that. And so you got to be careful. And again, you're absolutely right. I don't have the exact quote in front of me. I don't know the exact context in front of me. It doesn't sound like something I'd agree with, but maybe there's other factors that would be worthy of consideration, and there you go. But my point is this, whether that's exactly the way it was or not, that's not how you want to come across.
Yeah.
It's not helpful. On the second topic, which is movies that we love because of our association with our family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have that. I mean, there's a movie I don't particularly like, but I saw it with my dad, and even though it's sappy and kind of, it's a stupid movie, I looked over at my dad, and my dad was not a crier.
No.
I wouldn't call him, like, emotionally disconnected or anything like that, but he wouldn't cry a lot. I only caught him crying in movies a couple of times, and in real life, not much more than that. Not in real life, but you know what I mean? Like, in other situations. He was very stoic a lot of the time. So when I'm watching the movie fucking Armageddon, and I turn over, God. And my dad is... And it got my dad. Like, he got him. It got under his skin, and it made him cry a little bit. And it's a stupid movie about stupid meteors and stupid oil derrick guys and, like, guns that they bring into space to help drill into a meteor.
The government asked us to save the world. Anybody want to say no?
Yeah, like, it's... It's not a good movie. It's a very openly stupid movie. Mm. I can appreciate enjoying it. Certainly my dad did. And that's why even when I watch Armageddon again, I've had to watch it a few times every once in a while just for, like, you know, anniversary articles or something, writing something about Michael Bay. I've revisited it. I can't hate it because my dad kind of dug it. And I love my dad very much and I miss him. And it got under his skin and I kind of just see it through his eyes a little bit.
I've never seen Armageddon.
I know. You would hate it, I think.
I think I would. That's why I haven't seen it.
Yeah,
I
don't even enjoy The Rock, which is actually pretty muted for Michael Bay. So, like, I can't imagine
in fact,
you would be a super big fan of Armageddon.
The Rock was the one that just sort of made me close the book on the genre altogether. It's like, I've had enough. I don't need any more chases or guns. And it was The Rock. And everybody says, no, that's the good one.
Then
I don't want to see the bad ones, do I? Right.
Michael Bay is not making movies specifically for you.
That's he's making the opposite of what I want to see.
Yeah, anyway.
Is there any films that I like? You know what? I've had a few, like, interesting bonding experiences with family members over certain movies. My, again, to cite our fathers, my dad, when I refer to dad movies, that does apply to my own dad.
Sure.
He likes the Man with No Name trilogy. He likes shoot 'em ups. He calls them shoot 'em ups. And we actually had this wonder when I was, you know, became a professional film critic. He's like, okay, well, I haven't seen a lot of action movies since, you know, Duck, You Sucker. So, show me something good, something new. So, we had a good bonding experience watching newer to him movies like Speed or Under Siege, you know, these movies, a Hard Target, films from the 90s that he hadn't caught up on that
pretty
I thought he might enjoy.
Flicks, yeah.
And he liked Under Siege.
Understood, fun.
But his complaint was there's a knife fight at the end with Tommy Lee Jones and Steven Seagal. And Steven Seagal is holding the knife in such a way as if he's going to stab down like a slasher villain.
Yeah.
And that's the way he holds it throughout the fight. Like, he's going to lunge forward and stab him. And he says, that's not how you hold a knife in a fight. You hold it underhand so you can lunge forward. You have more range that way. Mm-hmm. That's the whole point of a knife fight, is you have more range and you can cut him. And, like, that was his entire experience with Under Siege, was he was holding the knife wrong in the final knife fight.
Two things with that. Not a family member, but someone I went to college with, he was a huge Steven Seagal movie fan. I don't know how I felt about the guy, because the guy's an asshole, but, like, he loves Steven Seagal movies, because they're big and stupid and very funnily written, and... there was a theater at our film school, like, on the first floor, and they would held, like, revival screenings there, and there were sometimes classes in there, and for whatever reason, I still don't know what class it was, they were showing Under Siege. So we're in, like, the editing bay, like, working on, like, our final projects or whatever like that, and all of a sudden my friend Brett comes in, it's like, they're showing Under Siege in the theater! I'm like, oh, shit! And we all, like, lock up our shit, and we run downstairs, and it's, like, halfway through the movie, but we all just sit down in the back, and I remember that scene where Steven Seagal and Tommy Lee Jones fight with knives. And this is when my friend Brett turns to me and says, this is the part where they fight with knives! Like, that was his favorite part, is where they fight with knives. This is a guy who could describe the plot of the movie Glimmer Man, and you would want to give him a fucking Pulitzer. Like, just, he's just like, what an incredible narrative is the Glimmer Man.
The Glimmer Man. I also bonded with my mom.
Yeah.
My mom and dad divorced when I was 3, so I had 2 very separate parenting experiences with them.
Mm-hmm.
We never saw movies all together, but I went to go with my mom to see The Passion of the Christ, which opened on Good Friday, if you recall.
I'm
a church goer, but we're not, we're more about the resurrection in our church than the violence and the beating. That's more of a Catholic thing.
Yeah.
It's like the passion and how much he suffered was, like, a big part of Catholic faith.
Yeah.
Not so much in the church we go to. And so we're watching this thing, and we are being complete assholes in the theater, my mom and I. And my mom is of course, the worse of it. And, like, we're kind of, like, snickering, and, like, they're hoisting him up, and he's bleeding. It's like, oh, you just watched him get the ever-loving tar beaten out of him for 2 hours. And my mom starts singing Always Look on the Bright Side of Life in the theater. Not a full voice or anything, but she's, like, enough that I could hear it, and we couldn't make it. Like, we just lost it. It's like, Mel Gibson, you lost us. And you know, when the camera wells up and we see God's tear falling from the sky, it's like, oh, okay, we couldn't stand it anymore. We were just snickering and laughing throughout the rest of that movie. And as such, watching The Passion of the Christ with my mom was one of the funniest, most enjoyable experiences I've had in a movie theater, just because we were having such a great time laughing at this ultra-violent movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Somebody recut it with like Benny Hill music and sped it up.
That's a bit
adding like the cartoon sound effects, bonk, bonk, bonk. It's pretty hilarious.
Yeah. It's not a subtle film.
No, not at all.
Not a particularly subtle motion picture.
And it's rated R, and then they recut it. It was still rated R.
Why did they recut it?
It was just slightly less violent.
Roger, still are.
Roger Ebert made an excellent point. He said if it was anybody other than Jesus on that cross, that would be an NC-17 rated film.
Yeah, it's a fucked up film.
Yeah.
Anyway. All right. Hopefully that answers your question a little bit, but thank you for writing in.
Thank you for writing in.
I think we've got time for one more.
Okay, here's a letter from just the letter T. Hello, Ooh. T. Hi, fellas. I've been meaning to write this one for a while as we're getting tantalizingly close to the finish line. I'm guessing in the pandemic. I've been wanting to reach out to all the podcasts that have helped me get through the last year and just personally express my thanks for keeping me sane. Well, you're quite welcome.
Glad we could help.
I'm a psychiatrist, so never stayed home, although my primary work has been dealing with the ways in which people have dealt with the stress and isolation and all too frequently substance abuse. In April of 2020, when things were dire in New York, they threw every single body they could at the waves of patients, getting the list of film recommendations gave me something to escape into. I really enjoyed getting to learn about you guys, and now anticipate that if Whitney has a reaction to something, I'll have the opposite one. I'm glad I was able to remain a patron. Strongly encourage anyone who is able and who isn't already to sign up, and happily report that my mom loved her Salt Cat soap.
Oh, that's great. Amen. Thank you.
Yeah. Anyway, and all the time you discover new things... And all the time you've had to discover new things, film or not, during this long, long year, is there one thing you feel that everyone should experience? For me, it was Ohazar Balthazar, something I've heard Dave White plug many times. Dave White has said it's his favorite movie.
Yeah.
And then once Whitney recommended it, I decided that I shouldn't wait. See Ohazar Balthazar.
I haven't seen
it. Robert Bresson is wonderful.
I haven't seen that one.
In any case, you both have my profound thanks for everything you did and continue to do. Gratefully, T. P.S. I wish I could convince Whitney to watch The Living End. I think it would be either the first thing we could agree on or would finally make us mortal enemies. Yeah, I haven't seen Greg Araki's The Living End. I run hot and cold on Greg Araki. I really admire what he does, but I kind of hate some of his movies.
Yeah, he's not trying to be liked, is he?
No, and I really, really love his film Mysterious Skin. I think that's his best, most mature movie in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But then he came out with Kaboom after that, and Kaboom sucks. I like the cast, you know, and he has a knack for like creating these really kind of young, funny, sexy characters, but yeah, his movies aren't always great. As for having the opposite opinion, good.
Yeah, no, that's great.
If you know where I'm coming from and you know what I'm going to say, adjust accordingly. And I don't expect you to agree with me.
I've had a lot of people try to insult me by saying, I know if Bibbs likes a movie, I know I'm going to hate it and vice versa. And I'm like, then I'm doing a great job.
Yeah.
Like it's not my job to be agreed with or to agree with you. It's my job to clearly articulate things, to have my opinions and my stances on things be clear. And if that helps you, if that means if I like something, you're likely to like it, awesome. If it means you're likely to dislike it, also useful, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's good to know.
Fair enough. I want you to listen to me and understand me, not have my taste. My taste is mine.
Yeah.
That's my taste.
It's nice when we agree on things and we can share these experiences, but it's no fun if we all like the same shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I understand that my taste is really weird. So if I found somebody who did agree with me, I'd think, are you in this dimension to replace me? I react to very strange things, so I'm going to say that. I don't want you to agree with me.
Yeah.
Under any circumstances, I want you to understand me, and that's what we're getting at here.
I want to, regarding your question about what's something you want other people to enjoy, and I'm going to try to think of a couple of movies in a second, but I actually am going to step outside of that box for a minute, and one of the things that really helped me and M. Lopez Silva get through the pandemic was actually finding new creative pursuits. And we've gotten way more into crafting than I ever thought I would. I was like doing crafting in school and stuff, but it never really persisted as a hobby. And now we make soap, and it's actually a fascinating art form, and it's really interesting, and I like doing it, and I know she loves it in particular. We've started playing around with resin and even candle making a little bit, and it's really fun. And you get to actually like be creative and also produce something with a practical use. It's an art form, and it's also just practically building things. I love doing that, and I would encourage anybody to try to find, if you don't already have a hobby that involves, and I know not everybody has the same skill set or the same ability to work with their hands. I myself am very clumsy. I'm not actually very skilled in terms of like fine work. But even just coming up with fun color schemes and scents and things, that in and of itself is very satisfying. So I definitely encourage people to, like, we're all here because we love movies. It's kind of like the point of our channel is movies and TV. But always remember that there's stuff outside of that.
Yeah.
So don't forget to, even if you're focusing your whole life around movies, and I know a lot of people that listen to us do because it's a wonderful pastime, and it's a wonderful pursuit, and it's wonderful art, and it brings a lot of meaning to my life. Don't forget there's other stuff. Yeah, so every once in a while, step out of that and try something else. Definitely do that. Whether it's crafting or whatever it is, just make sure you step out of it once in a while. It's really invigorating for me right now at this point in my life.
This last year, you've kind of heard it, the things I've experienced. There's not a lot outside of it. I watch movies, and then I come here and I talk about them. During the year, my son was in kindergarten. Remote kindergarten is kind of a miserable experience. Just generally speaking, you know, my son is getting some education, but you know, it's just not ideal in any way. I imagine there were some kids who took to it, but you know, a lot of kids didn't. And I'm kind of anticipating sort of what the long term psychological effects of all of this are going to be on my poor son.
It's almost hard. It's almost impossible to predict this is going to do to the impressionable generations.
So far, he seems a lot more reluctant to go out. He's just used to being home now, and I don't think he's like afraid. I don't think he's anxious about going outside. I think he just doesn't want to.
It's not part of the repertoire.
I'm not sure if there's anything I really discovered, but a lot of the things I would do, I would like listen to a lot of music and lectures in the car. I'm very fond of The Great Courses, which is just a series of lectures by seasoned professors, and they have a field of expertise. I like to listen to the ones on philosophy and literature, but The Great Courses has all kinds of topics, and, you know, technology and history and all the rest. They've had to rebrand recently. There's a lot of like self-help stuff, you know, how to get through your day, how to deal with stress. Some of them are like how to learn how to play guitar. Some of them are a lot more instructional than they used to be. And they had to change their name to Wondrium, which I hate.
That's not fun.
Just call it The Great Courses. It's fine. That's a little bit more, you know,
It is what it is. It's what it says on the tin.
It's Great Courses. It's lectures. If you are into learning and lectures, this is what you got. And I haven't had a lot of time to read and read great literature in this time, which was, you know, for a long time a great hobby of mine, and it's just sort of fallen off in recent years. That was my outlet for a long time, is to listen to these lectures for The Great Courses. They fill my mind, and they, you know, make me feel like I'm actually learning something, and that's nice.
I made what one could call a mistake. It certainly was a choice. I turned my hobby into my career. And they say that if you do that, you'll never work a day in your life. Lies.
No.
However,
now your fun is just work.
I think it's a little reductive too. What I will say is this. There's a downside to it. I do love what I do. And the idea of doing other things, can be very unpleasurable to me. Because being able to make a living, even a meager living, even if I'm barely making ends meet and I'm wondering seriously if I should be doing this, sounds better to me than almost any other alternative. Because I like what I do. However, it also can become an element of stress. And turning your hobby into a career, ultimately, for better or worse, whether you love your career or not, means that you don't have a hobby anymore. And I think that's what I'm getting at.
Okay.
Have something else to do. And that's something that I've struggled with, and I haven't always had that. So finding that more recently in the last year has been really, really helpful to me. Regarding movies and stuff. This is... I don't remember the last time we actually talked about this. But if you're listening to us for long enough, this might be a cliche. But I really do mean it. The Step Up movies. The Step Up movies are to the dance genre what the Fast and the Furious are to the action genre. Wildly implausible, full of wonderful characters.
And 100% earnest.
100% sincere. This whole thing where people are like, ah, oh, it's all about family, and you kind of get into that and you start believing it. It's like that, but instead of having car chases, they have insane dancing. It's great. We were talking about how, like, you know, you need to be open to, like, genres you might otherwise have ignored. And I know a lot of people who roll their eyes at the very concept of the dance movie genre. Some people don't even agree that it's a genre. Lies.
Well, what would you call them? Movies that are based around dance?
Musicals. Okay. Some people think it's just all part of musicals. Whatever. It's a subgenre.
Fine, whatever.
My point is this. You should be open to it. And we just stumbled into Step Up 3D one day. And it ended up changing our lives. And it brought us so much cinematic joy.
I brought you with
joy.
Me, too. I was going to go. I was like, want to join? You're like, yeah, sure. I'll see Step Up 3D.
Yeah, and we were just totally just... I had seen Step Up 2 and I liked it, but it wasn't until Step Up 3D that I realized just how incredibly elaborate and over the top, what a glorious like celebration of cinema it could be, let alone dance. And they're also kind of silly and they're kind of thrown together with like duct tape and chicken wire. But there's something just truly sincere and earnest about that. And that's what I want people to find. I want people to find sincere, earnest cinema. Even if it's not slick, even if it's not in a genre that you like, because I grew up, in particular from like my teenage years through like the early 2000s, in a very cynical, ironic age of cinema where people were rolling their eyes at the very idea of taking something seriously. It's one of the reasons why, like the Twilight movies are kind of dumb, but the thing that I think people reacted to most negatively about them was the fact that they took themselves seriously.
Yeah. Well, and I would say sexism was a big part
of it. Well, sexism was part of it too, but I think the fact that they were taken seriously, like if they were like ironic about themselves, I think some people would have given them a pass on a lot of things. But I think because they were just earnest movies about teenagers falling in love with each other.
Feeling intense love and not doing anything to address the admittedly sillier parts of the story.
Yeah, yeah. And they're totally in there, and I'm not going to pretend that they're not. But the thing that made me unable to connect with them for a while was I wasn't ready to appreciate them unironically. I want people to be able to engage with film on a non-superficial level. I want people to engage with the film on a sincere level, whatever that means. And different movies do that in a different way. And I think that's something. I think when you can do that, when you're not just looking at them as a show, when you're not like putting a wall up that prevents yourself from like emotionally connecting with what's going on, even if it's not like incredibly refined. If you can do that, if you can strip away that barricade, you can get so much more out of almost any movie. Yeah. And that's what I kind of want people to do. I don't know. I got off on a sidetrack, I guess.
Well, but to expand on that point, I think, I grew up on this era too. I'm a little older than you. So I was, doing it as a teenager when you were doing it as a kid. But I also think that kind of irony, that kind of distance, is also a very useful tool.
It can be.
I'm not saying it's inherently bad. That's something Mystery Science Theater 3000 taught us, that, these movies that were fodder, weren't given any kind of critical consideration, and let's be honest with ourselves, most of them are just pretty bad. Just badly made, not worth your time otherwise.
Previously
dismissed.
Many of them. Some are good.
But yeah. Some are good. I actually think some of those movies that they've covered are enjoyable on their own.
Yeah.
But what Mystery Science Theater did is saying these movies do have value as entertainment.
Yeah.
We may be sort of like poking fun at them and sort of pointing out their failures, but we're enjoying ourselves.
But that's what I mean. There's a sincerity to that irony, even where like we're genuinely appreciating these movies as what they are, which is goofy and kind of badly made, and you can actually enjoy that.
Yeah,
and
you're actually getting something about the way cinema functions, while you're still you're putting yourself in an Olympian position, and I think there's not anything inherently wrong with that. It's just the way you wield it.
I think there's a difference between poking fun at something and saying to yourself that it's bad and that's why I'm doing it. You don't have to do that.
Mm.
You can say to yourself, this movie is silly, this movie is even badly made, but you don't have to elevate yourself, you don't have to put yourself on a pedestal in order to enjoy that, or even to have playful fun with it. And when I talk about wanting to appreciate movies sincerely, I'm not saying that irony is bad inherently. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that if it's your default position, I think you're missing out.
Yeah, well, and this is, you know, a trap that a lot of younger people fall into. They feel like you feel like you have the world nailed.
Yeah.
A movie comes out sight unseen, you feel like you know what it is, and you're willing to pass judgment on it immediately. And this goes back to the CinemaSins conversation. I grew up in the age of what you might call the cranky critic. In fact, I was very fond of a website back in the day called Mr. Cranky, and the joke was, it was a movie review website, but all the reviews were bad. Every film was bad. You know, Hollywood is this horrible machine. While there was legit criticism going on in there, it was essentially a comedy bit. Like, here's what it would look like if somebody hated every movie. And that had changed the timbre of the conversation a lot, to the point where people were going into movies looking for comedy bits, things to complain about. Mm. And that's where CinemaSins kind of came in. I thought they were sort of bringing that to a logical extreme. But yeah, as you pointed out, they're not savvy enough about it to make it read as satire, so it feels like the real thing. And yeah, all of a sudden, that youthful thing, that barrier you're talking about, starts to go up, because they're looking at films as fodder for comedy rather than something to legitimately criticize.
Exactly.
Anyway, I'm off on a tangent here. I'm way off the rails.
We both are. Yeah. We both kind of got off the...
It's late at night, and I kind of lost.
You know, I think it's after 1 a.m. I think we're both kind of winding down.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody, for writing in. It's a really interesting crop of letters this week. Really thoughtful things on your mind, and we just really appreciate everybody. It was very, very kind of some of you to say, you know, nice things about the show. Mm. And also very, very kind of you to reach out with your criticism in a respectful way that we can actually have a good conversation about it. That was cool. We just really appreciate all of you and really grateful that you're still here with us. Whether you're a patron or not, if you're a patron, extra special thank you, of course, because without you, we can't do this. If you want to join up on the Patreon, there's a lot of exclusive shows about Batman, Star Trek, the Oscars. We do commentary tracks, Google Hangouts, or it's not Google Hangouts anymore. We do online Hangouts. So we're especially just incredibly grateful to all of you for joining us on this journey, whether you can afford to contribute or not. And writing in makes us feel a lot less lonely in here. So that really helps too. We just love you all. And just hope you're getting through your week okay. And thank you for making us a part of it.
Yeah.
You can reach out to us on this show. We've got mail on our email address. And that email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We are also on Twitter at Critic Acclaim. I'm at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibold. Thank you.
Tell them about our P.O. box.
Yeah, if you want to send us an actual physical letter, we'd be happy to read that on this show. The P.O. box is the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. box 641565. That's 641565. Los Angeles, California, 90064.
We already said the Twitter and everything. And we mentioned Salt Cat Soap. Thank you, everybody who's bought Salt Cat Soap. We make soap. That's one of our things that we do here. Mm-hmm. And we have an Etsy store. So we go to Etsy and look for Salt Cat Soap, all one word. You will find designer soaps made by a few by me, some a lot more by M. Lapis mm-hmm. Silva, my wife and partner. They're really incredible. We released a whole bunch of new designs for July. And again, we're having a sale this month.
Mm-hmm.
We hope you enjoyed. Thank you for checking them out. And everyone likes soap, and it's good for you. Mm. So there's that. I'm so tired.
Okay, let's wrap this up.
We're just wrapping this up. Salt Cat Soap. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Salt Cat Soap. Thank you, everybody, once again. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.
I wanna go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?